You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 29th of March 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme, the UK notifies Brussels of its intention to leave the European Union.
What can I add to this? We already miss you. Thank you and goodbye.
European Council President Donald Tusk there. My guests, Michael Binion and Brian Klass, will be discussing what this means for the country in the weeks to come. Indeed, what it means for Europe in the weeks and months to come. Plus,
I am taking historic steps to lift the restrictions on American energy, to reverse government intrusion, and to cancel job-killing regulations.
We'll debate US President Donald Trump's approach to climate change and ask whether his latest executive order is enough to get the job undone. And we'll also learn whether Russian activist Alexei Navalny could be a genuine contender to challenge for the Russian presidency next year. That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome, one and all, to Midori House. My guests today are Michael Binion, Foreign Affairs Specialist for The Times newspaper, and Brian Klass, Fellow in Comparative Politics at the London School of Economics. Michael and Brian, welcome to you both. The UK government has sent Brussels its notification of the triggering of Article 50, the process which will now see the country withdraw from the European Union over the next 2 years. Unfortunately, the envelope wasn't delivered on a tank to Brussels. It was handed over in a very polite fashion. When explaining the decision to Parliament earlier today, Theresa May had this to say.
Perhaps now more than ever, the world needs the liberal democratic values of Europe. Values. Perhaps. Perhaps now than more than ever, the world needs the liberal democratic values of Europe. Values that the United Kingdom shares. And that is why, while we are leaving the institutions of the European Union, we are not leaving Europe. Mr. Speaker, we understand that there will be consequences for the UK of leaving the EU. We know that we will lose influence. We know that we will lose influence over the rules that affect the European economy. We know that UK companies that trade with the EU will have to align with rules agreed by institutions of which we are no longer a part, just as we do in other overseas markets, and we accept that. However, we approach these talks constructively, respectfully, and in a spirit of sincere cooperation.
That was Theresa May speaking in Parliament earlier today. Michael Binion, if I hadn't explained when that speech took place, and where, and who was saying it, you would almost think that was a speech in favour of the UK remaining in the European Union.
You would indeed, and you would also wonder why on earth she's now making it and taking us out of the European Union at this very moment when we're all beginning to wake up to the consequences. She's trying to anticipate the backlash that I'm sure is going to come when, during the negotiations over the next few years, we'll see some of the difficulties that will come up for British trade, for British exports, of course, and for our influence across Europe in political and economic fields.
You sound quite confident that people will change their minds. Why is that?
I'm confident they'll begin to understand the enormous consequences of what they voted for last year, and that there are severe disadvantages. There is no quick, easy exit with a simple break from 45 years of our history. And I think that that will come out because every detail of the negotiation, and there is a huge range of these, will come up to the front of our newspapers, our television broadcasts. We'll be following it. People will be bored silly of it in the end. But they can't fail to see that there are going to be enormous challenges.
Brian, one thing that's certainly clear, and there are very few things that are clear, but the one thing that is certain is that there now needs to be some meat put on the bones of what Brexit means. We have had 9 months or so of slogans, and before that we had slogans as well about taking back control and Brexit means Brexit. But now this is when the negotiations start and we start to realise what that actually entails.
Yeah, this is where the, you know, the rhetoric meets reality of governing. Campaigning is easy, governing is hard, and this is going to be the wake-up call for Britain, I think. The EU needs to approve the deal, and they hold a lot more leverage, I think, than the British government is acknowledging, which is probably why Theresa May is, you know, sort of setting out a lowering of expectations and a sort of acknowledgement of difficulties that lie ahead in that speech. This is, you know, it's going to be very hard going for the Brits. There is a fundamental truth here that I think it's obscured by all the back and forth of nothing bad has happened, even though we voted leave, etc. And this is that it is never good for your economy when you make it more difficult to trade with your largest trading partner. And that is no matter what happens in the negotiations going to occur. So I think it's very, very difficult to see any short-term upside. And this could have very, very severe long-term consequences for the dynamism of the British economy.
Michael, there were two or three interesting things within the letter that Theresa May wrote and signed in a photo op with a British flag in the background, which seems to have mysteriously started appearing in the Cabinet Office. It was never there in the past. There were a few things. One was she was very clear that Britain wouldn't, as she described it, cherry pick the parts of EU membership that it likes. So she said Britain understands that the four freedoms are indivisible, that you can't take one without the other. So that means freedom of movement is definitely off the table. But she also made a slight threat, didn't she, on security when she said, well, look, if our relationship, if our links aren't that strong, then that means they won't be that strong on issues of security and you need our help.
Yes, I think she rather played down those links. That's absolutely true. That is, in fact, Britain's strongest card. And Britain will be a very forceful, even more forceful, member of NATO now, because that's where we are still right at the heart of the alliance and where Britain's contribution to NATO is seen as very important and by our European allies. But I think apart from that perhaps veiled threat, she actually got the tone right. She was, first of all, respectful and polite about the European Union. Mm. And starting off, I mean, what was extraordinary, when she mentioned this word liberal values, liberal democratic values, there was a mixture of cheers and jeers. Now, the jeers, I think, came from the hardline Brexiteers. It came from her own side.
I don't know. I think that the jeers actually came from the Labour and SNP benches and Lib Dem benches, which were saying, yes, that's why we voted to remain.
I hope so, because that is why they voted to remain. But I have a fear that, I mean, it's very difficult in the hubbub to know exactly who was cheering, who was jeering. But I think the toughest part of all these negotiations is she's going to have to deal with the ultras, with the absolutists, with the total leave and destroy, the burn all bridges on her own side. And there are some people who not only don't like Britain's involvement in the European Union, they actually hate the concept of the European Union itself.
That's one of the issues, isn't it, Brian, going forward, in that, you know, while some people who voted for Remain might share Michael's view that, well, the more that people realise this isn't that great, they'll realise maybe they perhaps made a mistake. It's also possible that they will cast around for other people to blame, and it would be, well, it's those that didn't back Brexit hard enough, or that didn't help as much as they could.
There's going to be a lot of blame sharing, I think, to go around in the coming years. One of the problems, though, is that how do you ascribe blame in something that's going to take years to negotiate and then the fallout will take potentially decades to see the full entirety of it? I mean, the decisions that are being made as a result of Brexit will be planning decisions, banks not making investments they would have made. There's not going to be a smoking gun where you see Brexit did this. You'll just see changes in growth and very likely tepid growth. And so I think that the difficulty here politically is to determine what would have happened if the Remain camp had won. And then how do you deal with the blame of how much worse it was? I mean, and this is what was striking to me is when I've talked about Brexit since the vote, but before Article 50 was triggered today, a lot of people say, well, look at the results. And you say, well, it's really difficult to look at the results because nothing has fundamentally changed yet.
No.
And this is where the debate is, right? So what's going to happen in the next 2 years? Everyone's going to read the tea leaves. Then in the third year after the deal or no deal is struck, okay, how much of that is due to Brexit? How much of it is due to global trends? And so it's very difficult to pinpoint. And I think politicians will be masterful at trying to deflect blame and put it on others.
And that's the thing, isn't it, Michael, is that, you know, in 10 years' time, the UK's growth might be, say, you know, 2% a year. And some people will be able to say, well, look, see, that shows that Brexit wasn't that bad after all. But Remainers might turn around and say, ah, yes, but, you know, if we hadn't voted to leave the European Union, it would have been 5%. Once, you know, this happens, it's, you can't get into this, you know, world of what ifs and if we'd done this and if we'd done that. The reality is the reality.
You can't second guess history, but you made an interesting point when you said in 2 years' time, the United Kingdom. How do you know there's going to be a United Kingdom in 2 years' time? I think this process is very likely to trigger an enormous internal upheaval. Scotland, we know, is going to have a referendum. I'm not sure they're going to win it, but the fact that they're going to have it right at the time we're trying to negotiate for the whole United Kingdom is going to be an added complicating factor. And Northern Ireland, don't write them off as well, because the fact of reinstituting an Irish border could be one of the big, tricky negotiating points, and that would be pretty well death for both parts of Ireland.
Well, indeed. Actually, I wanted to ask you, Michael, about Northern Ireland, because the thing about Scotland and the European Union is that the SNP cannot deliver what they necessarily say they want, which is a Scotland inside the European Union. If they leave the UK, they then have to apply to rejoin the European Union. For Northern Ireland, however, were Northern Ireland to vote to join the Republic of Ireland, they would get to remain in the European Union.
They would indeed. And that, of course, is that gives the Yes campaign or the Leave campaign or the ones who would have wanted to leave a pretty strong hand. There will be a backlash, not because of joining the European Union, but the idea of the Northern Ireland of the Six Counties becoming part of the Republic will be the dream fulfilled for Sinn Féin, which, of course, will antagonise the Unionists in a huge way. But nevertheless, if it comes down to an economic problem and the border is going to be reinstated, even the Unionists would see that as a great disadvantage, and they might be swayed in some kind of deal where they're much closer to the Republic, possibly even part of them, but certainly in a single customs union with them.
Brian, I want to go back to this issue of security, you know, this sort of threat by Theresa May that, you know, well, if Britain's out of the European Union, we don't have a good deal, we might not be able to share as much with you as we have in the past. Do you think that's actually necessarily true, given that the UK will still be a member of NATO? There are, I think, 22 members of both the EU and NATO. Britain is not going to refuse to share information that's going to help a NATO ally, is it?
Well, I think it probably is a bluff, but there's, you know, there's a lot of attempts to find leverage wherever you can in this negotiation on both sides. This is, as Michael Reilly pointed out, one of the stronger cards that Britain has. But I also think that, you know, you have to keep in mind that a lot of the EU politicians who are debating this, the ones who are involved in the negotiation, the ones who have to approve it at the end, they have staked their careers on building Europe. And so, you know, if it comes to a choice between a economic hit that is involved with sort of a weakened tie with Europe, maybe a loss of some security sharing, or the breakdown of the EU on the other hand, they're going to pick anything that preserves the union, the European Union. And so, you know, from my perspective, it's one of these things where a lot of optimists in the city would say, oh, they wouldn't possibly weather economic damage to, you know, they wouldn't inflict this wound on themselves. They absolutely will, because they have spent decades trying to fulfill this dream, and they know that if Britain comes out of this with a good deal, that's going to trigger the likelihood of more Brexit copycats elsewhere.
But is it, though? I mean, it's. I know that was the story before Brexit happened, but when you look at the polls around Europe since the Brexit vote, actually you've seen support for the European Union rise pretty much across the board, by considerable margins.
But that's That's primarily because of the uncertainty of the negotiation and the fact that people are realizing that there may be consequences to Brexit. I think if at the end of 2 years, Britain gets a sweetheart deal, or at least it emerges unscathed, there will be more push from other countries to leave the union, or for the union to be downgraded within other countries. So I think, you know, I think that this is one of the real risks.
Do you share that view, Michael?
Yes, but particularly in Eastern Europe. I think that's where the real problems are. I don't think there's much risk that Western Europe, even though there is anti-EU sentiment and it's quite strong in France, and there's, you have to distinguish between anti-euro, the currency sentiment, which is fairly widespread, particularly in places like Italy, and anti-EU sentiment, which I think is still fairly weak. But in Eastern Europe, there's anti-both, as both anti-euro and anti-EU, particularly in countries where there's a much more nationalist government than there was, say, Poland or Hungary.
Yes, but even in those countries, Poland and Hungary, they are anti the leadership in Brussels and the leadership of the European Union. But given the amounts, the billions that both those countries in particular still get from the rest of the EU in EU funds, and the fact that, you know, Poland in particular is benefiting from so many of its citizens going to other countries and bringing money back, economically, yeah. it doesn't make sense. They can rail against leadership, but it doesn't make sense for them.
You're absolutely right. I don't think there's any likelihood they're going to apply to leave. I think that's extremely unlikely. What I do think is they will be a very difficult customer, as Britain was when it was a full member, and they will put the brake on at every attempt of deeper integration, and they will try to make sure that any moves in Brussels are really only suiting Poland's national interests.
Okay, let's move on now. Yesterday, US President Donald Trump signed his latest executive order with the intention of repealing many of the initiatives put in place by his predecessor, Barack Obama, to help save the environment. Executive orders are used by US presidents when trying to navigate around pesky things like Congress, but they're not always successful. Obama himself signed one to close Guantanamo Bay, and that is still open. And despite signing 278 others in 8 years, his enthusiasm pales in comparison to Franklin D. Roosevelt, who signed a grand total of 3,721 during his 12 years in office. But Brian, to look at the order that Mr. Trump has signed now, how much of this is about the symbolism of President Trump saying, look, I told you I was in favour of coal mining and oil drilling and against this green nonsense, and here's the proof. See, look, I've done something. And how much of it actually is quite damaging to America's attempts to tackle climate change?
Well, symbolism was certainly important. The signing ceremony, Trump surrounded himself by coal miners. So, I mean, it was obviously this symbolic aspect. He said he's keeping his promise, et cetera, et cetera. I think what it does is it presages a wider assault by the Trump administration on environmental protections, where the executive branch actually has a fair amount of latitude to roll back protections because they're charged with environmental enforcement. The budget Trump submitted has massive cuts to the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency. You know, the head of the EPA is an enemy of the mission of the EPA, which is to protect the environment. And Trump doesn't believe in climate change, you know, at least as far as his public statements have suggested, where he's called it a hoax created by the Chinese to make U.S. manufacturing less competitive. So even though the executive order will not all of a sudden stop every effort the U.S. government has made to address climate change in its tracks, it's part of a wider effort the Trump administration is going to invoke in this vein. It can be stopped. They have not signaled that they'll stop the Paris Climate Accord. They have not signaled that they'll pull out yet. They're still under consideration. And critically, lawsuits can really hold this up. So the name of the game for Democrats and for people who believe in climate change and believe it should be stopped is run out the clock. Because if they can slow down this till 2018 and the Democrats win one of the branches of Congress, they can really stop a lot of the damage from being done on Trump rolling back these protections.
And Michael, when it comes to the Paris Agreement, this is one of those issues where, as much as Trump may give the impression he doesn't care what his allies think, he knows that, you know, were he to pull the US out of Paris or try to pull it out, the country out, it's quite complicated, it'll take a while, that actually that will frustrate many of his allies who will be trying to persuade him not to.
It will indeed, yes, particularly the allies in Western Europe, who were very strong supporters of this. And there was reluctance in the United States all along to get them to sign up to the Paris Agreement. Then Obama, the administration, embraced it. And the problem was getting other big polluters on board, especially China and India. And they really only came on board because they were convinced that the United States would make those sacrifices that they said they would, and that they would actually sign up to all those rather far-reaching targets. Now, if it looks as though the Americans are going to renege on these, then the Chinese, who also have a strong industrial lobby of their own and depend very heavily on coal, may start thinking, well, we can actually slow down on this as well. And that would be a serious damage to the whole treaty.
Brian, to pick up on what Michael was saying before about Brexit and people who, you know, perhaps realizing they made a mistake, you know, there will be some Democrats who look at the major former coal mining states and say, well, look, you know, they'll soon realise that Donald Trump isn't actually going to bring coal mining back. He might talk this talk, but those jobs are gone. You can't bring them back. But even if, as looks likely, those jobs don't come back, those voters aren't necessarily going to think, well, Donald Trump told us a pack of lies. They're going to think, well, at least he tried to bring them back.
Yeah, I think that that's true. I think that in West Virginia, Trump will continue to be popular. But, you know, misery catches up with politicians. And if the jobs don't come back, then you have to blame somebody. And it's pretty easy to blame the party that's controlling the White House, the House, and the Senate when things are going badly. You know, keep in mind that Trump has overpromised. And this is something that is a trademark of his presidency, of his campaign, of his personality. He said, for example, that the Keystone Pipeline would create 100,000 jobs. The best estimate says that the construction of the Keystone Pipeline will be 1,000 jobs, 35 of them will be permanent, right? He said that the Keystone Pipeline will be created with U.S.-only steel. Now that's not true. It's going to be created with foreign steel. And he said that coal mining is coming back, and it's not. So, you know, at some point, even though people appreciate that he's trying, coal miners are not the heart of America, right? They just simply are not a large enough voting bloc to matter. So it's symbolic. It's great that they're feeling empowered again. But the reality is that, you know, as he's doing this, what he's actually doing is undermining their future, because a responsible political agenda for coal miners is to find job retraining that allows them to have sustainable and actually permanent jobs for the future. The longer that he strings them along and says, you know, and sells them these, you know, false promises and false hopes, the more that their lives are going to be torn asunder when it becomes clear that he's overpromised and undersold.
Michael, do you think that's right? Do you think that the promises that aren't delivered will come back to bite him eventually?
Well, I think that's precisely right. I do think that at the moment he's just putting off the day when he's sort of found out. He is doing a lot of symbolic stuff very early on, because he wants to show that his critics were wrong and that he's a man of action and will deliver on all these different things where, as Brian says, he has massively overpromised. Well, he can start it all, but what I think he's hoping is that in the end, a lot of this stuff will get sort of slightly lost in the mist of bureaucracy. The sort of people won't quite know why it isn't going through. They'll realise that it's perhaps not being delivered in the way that he promised, but they won't exactly be able to say, well, he's broken his promise. They'll just say, well, he's still trying, and we'll see.
Brian, I want to pick up on something you just said about how the Republicans control, you know, the White House, the Senate, and House of Representatives. In a sense, could you argue actually there are two parties that are controlling these branches? There's the Republicans that are controlling the Senate and the House of Representatives, and then there's Donald Trump who's controlling the White House. And Trump and the Republicans aren't necessarily the same thing. This is the man who, you know, campaigned against all hard right Republican orthodoxy during the primaries. He has clearly has no problem in trying to shift the blame onto the Freedom Caucus or Paul Ryan or even his own chief of staff, who's a more traditional Republican. You can see, can't you, a way where he tries to ease blame onto those Republicans, politicians, those normal Washington politicians, and sort of keep himself a bit separate.
He's going to try that for sure. You know, I've always said with Trump, there is a Venn diagram at play here. And the center of that Venn diagram between the Republicans and the Trump people is basically tax cuts, deregulation, and hating Obamacare. Now, with hating Obamacare, they weren't able to coalesce. And so I think that there's, you know, a lot of expectations. You saw this in the stock market. You saw this in sort of the way Republicans played the post-election, you know, fervor in the business community, that there's this massive unity because they now control all three areas. And actually, there's not. The Tuesday group, the moderates in the House, are very different from the Freedom Caucus on the far right. Trump is very different from most every Republican. But I think at the end of the day, voters blame the president. You know, when things go badly, you know, keep in mind, Obama got blamed even though the Republicans controlled the House and the Senate for the large part of his presidency. So at the end of the day, Trump is going to deflect blame. He's already signaled he'll blame Obamacare on Obama. But, you know, people blame the president when things go badly.
And his approval ratings are currently at 36%. Okay, we're going to take a very short break. When we're back, we're talking Russia.
The Big Interview, the show that brings you the fascinating life stories of some of the most influential people in the world of art and culture, business and politics, continues this week with Kristin Scott Thomas.
We actors give the director and the editor and everyone else involved in the film and the making of the film sort of raw material to do their job with.
The Academy Award nominated actress sits down with Robert Bound to discuss the creation of a character, why she managed to resist Hollywood directing her first film, and the unique demands of being an actress.
I was involved in this extraordinary film, which is having an extraordinary success, but then I had to keep talking about how wonderful and how cold it was in the desert at night and how wonderful it was to be working with Ralph Fiennes. And, you know, and it just got too much.
The Big Interview with Kristin Scott Thomas premieres this Sunday at 9 a.m. London time here on Monocle 24.
And you're back with Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield, here on Monocle 24. Still with me here in Studio One, Brian Klass and Michael Binion. Last weekend saw anti-corruption protests flare up across Russian cities, almost 100 of them, with at least 500 people detained in Moscow alone. The protests were led by the Russian lawyer and activist Alexei Navalny, who hopes to challenge President Vladimir Putin for the presidency next March. Michael Binion, he says he wants to stand for president. Technically, he can't. And even if he could, he wouldn't do very well, would he?
No, he wouldn't. There's not a hope. There's not zero chance that he would win the presidency and oust Putin. That's absolutely impossible. And as you say, almost certainly he'll be disqualified even from standing. But the fact is that
there is a but.
Yeah, there is a but. And that is he has touched a very, very raw nerve in the country. And Putin knows it. He knows it very well. In fact, I've always felt every time I've been to Russia in the last 3 years, the one issue on which Putin is vulnerable is corruption. People are extremely angry about it. It is very widespread. It is particularly visible and making people furious when it's around Putin's own inner circle. Mm. And that is Navalny's very, very smart tactic to pinpoint senior people, particularly Prime Minister Medvedev, rather than Putin himself.
Well, exactly, rather than Putin himself, yes.
The implication is Putin is tolerating it in his own circle. Mm. And the second implication is Putin himself is involved, but he doesn't ever say that. People may suspect it. But it's to pinpoint this issue, which is really, really corrosive for Putin.
What was interesting, Brian, about these protests was the age of many of those protesting. Many of them would have only really known Vladimir Putin as their president. I guess the question is whether these initial protests lead to further larger ones.
Well, it remains to be seen. I mean, the Russian government claimed, taking a page out of Trump's playbook, actually, that these were paid protesters. I mean, they said children were paid, you know, to come to the streets, as though anyone who would oppose Vladimir Putin must have been paid the same way Trump believes that anyone who opposes him must be paid. You know, I think that the age of the protesters is something that's common across protests in the world. I mean, you tend to have younger people doing this. But I think that, you know, the images from those protests will linger. You know, remember there were protests in 2011 that were, you know, they didn't amount to anything in the end. But, there, you know, all of this stuff adds up. And it adds up by showing that there is real opposition and that there is a real possibility to battle corruption in Russia.
Michael, they will linger here. Will they linger in Russia? Because, you know, if you turned on state TV, you wouldn't have seen these protests.
But people under 30 don't watch state TV. They look at what's on their telephones. They watch, they follow social media. Of course, there's attempts to control that and there's attempts to cut them off from the websites where they will see this. But that's pretty pretty difficult to do. And a lot of young Russians have a fairly good idea. And the other thing is that in Russia, word of mouth is the most powerful way people express ideas. It goes all around Russia. Rumours, even in Soviet time, have always spread very quickly.
OK, we'll leave it there. Michael Binion and Brian Klass, thank you both very much indeed. Midori House was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Helena Jarrett. The studio manager was Kira Matthew Benergi. We've got music next, then at 1900 hours, it's The Entrepreneurs with Danny Giacopelli. And of course, more on the day's main stories on The Monocle Daily. That's 2200 London time, 1700 in New York City. Midori House back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 in London, 1300 in New York. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.